Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. Here's a scientist soundbite.
All intelligent life is going to be made of the rarest stuff in the universe. But we're at a very special moment for our planet and especially our species. And that's why I think it's so important that people start to understand that the voice of science speaks with a great deal of consensus on issues like this. These are not things that are highly uncertain.
You're listening to astrophysicist Joel Premack of the University of California at Santa Cruz. Dr. Premack is a leading scientist on dark matter, material that doesn't interact with light or other radiation, but is thought to make up the bulk of our universe. He joins us now from radio station WBEZ in Chicago to talk about his new book, The New Universe and the Human Future. Dr. Premack, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, what is the main idea you're trying to get across in your book, The New Universe and the Human Future?
There are really two. One is that in the last decade or so, we astronomers have, for the first time, developed a theory of the origin, structure, composition, evolution, and future of the entire universe that actually seems to be right, that's based on extensive astronomical data, and that's now predicting the future. The theory has repeatedly made predictions that turned out to be right. The other idea is that this new theory of basically our origins, combined with recent work in biology, has now, for the first time, given all of humanity a possibly shared creation story. It's a creation story that nobody made up. It's a story that we've discovered. And as far as we can tell, it's the true story. Having a story like this for the entire world, which was created by the worldwide scientific community, we hope can be a basis for a new shared picture of reality, which is something that the Earth desperately needs so that we can all work together on solving our big problems.
All right. I mean, you open your book with a question, what universe are we living in? And I mean, beyond the obvious answer of this one, I mean, as a scientist, why is this question meaningful?
I think it's really important that people realize that there is now a scientific consensus on these fundamental questions of how the universe works on the macro scale and also how life works. And I think this is an important ingredient in coming to consensus on how to solve our really big problems on Earth.
So would you tell us some of the nuts and bolts here of this creation story that was developed by the scientific community over time? What is the shared cosmology, I guess, that you write about, and why is it important that everyone share a story about how the universe was created?
The first thing that I think everybody has to appreciate about the new picture is that everything that we see with our telescopes, all the galaxies, the stuff that absorbs light like dust and planets for that matter, all of that stuff represents about half of 1% of what's actually out there. Most of the universe is invisible. Now, this is such a crazy idea that it took scientists quite a while to appreciate that that's what's really going on. The reason we take it so seriously is that the predictions that follow from this, the detailed theory that is behind this, are so successful. We can predict the distribution of galaxies, both in the nearby universe and in the early universe that we see as we look out in space to great distances. We can understand the cosmic background radiation, the heat radiation of the Big Bang, and we can understand it in all of its details as far as we can tell. So this theory does appear to be extremely successful. The two main ingredients, the invisible stuff, are called dark matter and dark energy. Most of the mass in the universe is not made of atoms. It's not even made of the stuff that atoms are made of, protons, neutrons, and electrons. It's made of something else. And I have to start out by confessing right away, We don't know what this stuff is. But this is the sort of composition of the universe. As to how the universe evolved, the sort of creation story, there's lots of steps, and some of them are kind of technical. Briefly, we think that the Big Bang started with something called cosmic inflation, a sort of super expansion, which not only put the bang in the Big Bang, but also created the fluctuations in density, the slight differences from one region to another, that later grew into galaxies and clusters of galaxies in regions that are slightly higher than average density, and into what we call cosmic voids, where we don't find any galaxies in the regions of lower than average density. As time goes on, these small differences in density evolve into the great cosmic structures that we see in our telescopes. And we have a very detailed picture of how this works. Basically, the invisible dark matter stops expanding when the density gets a little higher than average. And then the ordinary matter, the atoms, fall to the center of these big dark matter blobs, and that's where stars form. And then generations of stars build up the rare heavy elements that our Earth and we ourselves are made out of. So that's the beginning of the next stage, which is biological evolution. And there, I think the most important thing to understand is that biological evolution seems to be largely a process of cooperation, where things that started as individual, sort of very simple cells came together to make complex cells with the formerly separate parts as organelles within cells, things like mitochondria. And then those cells learned how to form organs in bigger creatures, multicellular creatures. And in fact, it was the single-celled creatures that made our oxygen-rich atmosphere that made it possible for large creatures to evolve. So there have been a series of major changes as the universe has evolved, from inflation to ordinary expansion, the creation of galaxies, the evolution of the heavy elements, and then the evolution of life on planets formed largely of those heavy elements. Incidentally, the heavy elements, everything heavier than hydrogen and helium, which mostly came out of the Big Bang, represent 0.1% of the density of the universe. So that's the stuff we're made of, and that's the rarest stuff in the universe.
That was astrophysicist Joel Premack of the University of California at Santa Cruz. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
Now we question if we even ever relate. Now this fear will pass over. Now awake, but we cannot explain our surprise.
Earth Sky broadcast on over 1,200 stations worldwide, including Voice of America. Deborah Bird joins us now with news of the global night sky, a gift for sky watchers, a gathering of planets. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge. There are five planets visible to the eye alone, and all five of those planets can be seen in the December sky at some time during the night. So let's talk about the pre-dawn sky first. The planets Mercury, Saturn, and Mars are visible there. And paradoxically enough, the easiest one of those planets to identify right now is Mercury. And the reason is that Mercury is very, very low in the eastern sky shortly before the sun comes up. So if you have a reason to rise before the sun, you can look toward the east, toward the direction of the sun up, and you'll see a strangely bright object for being so low in the sky. Some people think Mercury is faint. In fact, it's pretty bright, and it'll be there. Actually, it's more southeast than east, as seen from the northern hemisphere. So, look in the same direction that the sun will come up, because, you know, the sun is coming up kind of far to the south now, because we're in winter, and hence so is Mercury. And that very bright object above the southeastern point will be the planet Mercury.
Mercury, and early birds will be able to also see Saturn and Mars?
Yeah, Saturn's not that hard to pick out right now either. And when you're picking out planets, you might want to think about the path that the sun travels across the sky during the day. That path is called the ecliptic. The moon takes that same path from east to west each day. And in fact, the planets also travel that same path because, of course, the planets in our solar system orbit the sun in a nearly flat plane. So that plane gets translated on our sky into a narrow band. And the planets, the moon, the sun all travel across that pathway, that ecliptic across our sky. So the planet Saturn right now is noticeable because it's bright. It's a planet, and it's pretty bright, and it's near a bright star. It's near the star Spica in the constellation Virgo. So when you're outside in the early morning looking for Mercury very low in the southeast, you can look up along that path that the sun travels during the day, and you might spot the next two brightest objects up along that pathway will be two bright objects, one of them Saturn. Saturn will be on the left, and the other one is the star Spica.
And can sky watchers see other planets coming up later in December?
Well, actually, again, there's five planets that are visible in the December sky. The other planet that's visible in the morning sky is the planet Mars. And there's no way for me to say on the radio without showing you a chart where Mars is. It is up in the pre-dawn sky. It's not like fabulously bright or anything. It's about as bright as Saturn or Mercury, however. It's, if you looked, you would think of it as one of the bright stars. But it's not in any noticeable pattern right now. So, to identify Mars, come to earthsky.org and look at the tonight area, and you can find a chart that'll show you how to find Mars. And so another thing that's really a good trick to finding these planets is to use the moon as the guide to that. And the moon will be passing Saturn and the star Spica on the mornings of December 19th and 20th. Then it'll be passing the planet Mercury on the morning of December 22nd. So mark your calendar, the 19th and 20th, the moon in the pre-dawn sky will be near the star Spica and the planet Saturn. And on December 22nd, the moon, the waning crescent moon, it'll be a very thin moon by the 22nd, will be near the planet Mercury.
And what about evening sky watchers?
Well, evening, I save the best for last, because evening, the two brightest planets are visible in the evening now, and it's so cool to go outside and see them. The planet in the western sky after sunset, very bright, brighter than any star. It's the brightest object up there besides the sun and moon. That's the planet Venus. And if you just look toward the west after sunset, you'll see it. Jupiter is the second brightest object in the sky after Venus, the second brightest star-like object in the sky after Venus. And you can see Jupiter high in the east now when the sun goes down. And it's going to be really cool over the coming months. Venus and Jupiter are going to be drawing closer together. Jupiter's going to be moving toward that western sky where Venus is hanging out right now. And by March, they'll be very, very close. So start watching them now and you'll get to see them close together.
It sounds like an awesome collection of planets to see for sky watchers in December.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a great time to look for planets. So everybody go outside and look up.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Beth Lebwohl joins us with an interview of a scientist leading efforts to create energy from just sunlight and water, like plants do. Welcome, Beth.
Hey, thanks, Jorge. So I spoke with Nate Lewis, who is a very esteemed chemist over at Caltech. In fact, he is the principal investigator of the Joint Center for Artificial Photosynthesis. And he works on artificial photosynthesis, which I wasn't familiar with before I spoke to him. But essentially, it's using special materials like semiconductors that, powered by light and surrounded by water, create energy the way that plants do. Okay, plants create energy, they make their own food, that's photosynthesis. But these cells, they don't create food, they create hydrogen fuel.
Plants figured out that the best way to make and harness clean energy would be to take the biggest resource we have, the sun, and to convert it into the thing that drives almost all energy consumption on our planet today, which is chemical fuel. But most of what plants make can't directly be used as fuel by humans. And so the same way that birds have feathers and we know that therefore it's possible to fly, but we don't build airplanes out of feathers, when we know it's possible to take the sunlight and make chemical fuel, we're going to build our own machines that are going to take sunlight and make directly fuel that anybody could use anywhere, anytime for their energy.
It's a little bit complicated, but essentially what he's explaining in this next bit is that these cells are built in a certain way that when light hits them, they can split water molecules. Water is composed of H2O. It splits the water molecules into oxygen and hydrogen. And hydrogen then becomes the hydrogen fuel. This is different from solar panels, because solar panels, they do not create fuel.
Yeah, it's amazing that this is so complicated. I mean, scientists haven't been able to figure out how to do this, and plants can just do this so easily.
Dr. Lewis hasn't even been able to figure out how to do it. He's tinkering with all the parts. So here he explains what he's doing.
We know it's possible with semiconducting materials, like the ones used in solar panels, but a different set of materials, to actually take those materials and, instead of covering them with electrical wires, to immersing the material in water and with sunlight, then one can split that water and produce hydrogen gas and oxygen gas directly.
And I think it's important to note here that hydrogen fuel is an exceptional fuel because, unlike fossil fuels, when it combusts, there is no carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas known to be causing global warming. None of that is released into the atmosphere. The only byproduct is water. So that's one advantage. The other is that this technology relies on a relatively infinite resource, which is sunlight.
It's clean. And
it's clean.
There's no smog coming out the tailpipe.
So I asked Dr. Lewis, you know, when are we going to see this technology broadly applied? And his answer, as you know, as is sometimes the case in science, is he doesn't really know. But
it's a hard problem.
Yeah, it sure is. And Dr. Lewis told me why it's so important.
If we want to get to a clean energy system, we can get part of the way there with existing technology, with wind, with solar, with nuclear, but you can't get all the way there with just making cheaper what we know. And the two biggest challenges are, how do you store massive quantities of electricity, and how do you make clean fuel for the 40% of transportation that cannot be electrified, our ships, our aircraft, our heavy-duty trucks? And other than a limited amount of biofuels, the only technical game in town that could solve both of those problems that we have to solve as a planet in order to make a sustainable, environmentally responsible, secure future is to make fuel from the sun. And that's why we are working so hard on that project.
That was Nate Lewis of Caltech, interviewed by Beth Lebwohl. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Mother Falcon, Sleep Good, Dana Falconberry, 100 Flowers, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. Oh, but we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't end it. There are fine. What you don't know won't hurt ya. Oh, but you don't know, but you don't know, but you don't.